Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Welcome back to this week's episode of Her Leading Story. I'm so excited that you're joining us, and I am especially excited about this week's guest. I'm going to be interviewing Amy Kaufman, who is a financial activist and founder of Studio Watershed. With more than two decades in the social sector, Amy's been leading positive change, weaving together strategy, scale, finance, and data in a way that makes real impact. Amy's all about deep partnerships and working towards social justice. I am really thrilled that Amy was able to join us for this episode. I have known her for over 15 years. She lived down the street from me, and at the time she was working for the city of Chicago. And she'll probably talk some about that. And I hadn't quite kept up with what had happened in her work until I noticed some events and some talking engagements from her that kept popping up on LinkedIn, where she's been doing a lot of financial activist work with nonprofits. And so I'm going to let her talk about what Studio Watershed is and what it does and what financial activism means to her and how she works with nonprofits to scale and manage their finances. But what we also talk about is what she did in her earlier career and how she made her way to work in the city of Chicago and then founded Studio Watershed. So enjoy this episode, and thanks for joining us this week, and especially thanks to Amy for being here. Okay, I am so excited today to be here with my friend Amy Kaufman. And Amy, thanks so much for agreeing to come and be an interviewee. I would love to start with just you introducing yourself and telling the audience a little bit about what you do now.
Well, I'm super happy to be here and to talk to you. It's really fun. I am a financial activist and a consultant and an artist and a dot connector in the social impact space. And I love to work with nonprofits and with foundations and corporate social responsibility practices. And I work at the intersection of strategy, finance, scale, and data, and where all those things intersect for organizational leaders.
Great. And you have your own consulting firm right now. Is that right?
So I founded Studio Watershed, which is a social impact consulting firm, and I founded it 11 years ago. So I'm excited. We're starting our 12th year of business and feel really great about the number of clients that we've worked with. And we work with both really small community-led organizations on the south side of Chicago. And then across the country, we work with really large foundations such as the Gates Foundation and Walton and sort of everything in between.
That's amazing. See, this is why I like to talk to people that I already know on my podcast. Because I'm like, I kind of know what they do, but I don't really know what they do.
Yes. It's pretty niche what we do, and it's been really fun to get to know a lot of different areas within social impact and what that really means.
Yeah, great. So what I want to do first, I think, is just go back to the beginning. When you think back to being like 18 or thereabouts and going off to college, do you see the seeds of what you're doing now? Like as something that you felt strongly about either in high school or college, or like, tell me the story a little bit about how things emerged for you.
I always, from a pretty early age, knew that I wanted to work helping communities that had less than what I had growing up. And I'm Jewish, and through my synagogue, volunteered at a soup kitchen that still exists in the uptown area called the Inspiration Cafe. And I went with this woman who sort of organized this on an ongoing basis. And I'm still in touch with her today, which is pretty cool. And I realized that she did this for a living. This was her job. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. And so I started borrowing my parents' car in high school and would drive down to the soup kitchen on my own and kind of started volunteering. And so when I got to college, I did my undergrad in Indiana and always knew that I wanted to work in policy. I was actually also an art major, which is this like creative left brain, right brain side of me, and thought maybe I would actually work in low-income communities in after-school art programs or working for the National Endowment for the Arts, sort of that intersection of arts and policy. And when I graduated, I realized, wow, it's really hard to get a job as an artist and working in the arts. And so leaned a little bit more heavily into the policy, sort of public administration realm of things.
And then did you move like straight from Indiana back to Chicago area?
No,
or was there something in between?
Yeah, I lived in Atlanta actually for 4 years. I was sitting with a friend. This was like at the height of the dot-coms when everyone was getting flown all over for signing bonuses. And that's when I realized, wow, majoring in art has different benefits than majoring in the B school. And so she said, let's just like pick up and move somewhere totally different. And it was right after the Olympics when Atlanta was getting a lot of press. And so we just on a whim moved to Atlanta, and I got a job actually as a lobbyist working at the Chamber of Commerce. And the reason that I was super interested is because the Arts and Business Council of that city was housed within the chamber. And so they were connecting arts and business leaders to the arts organizations in Atlanta. So I worked as like an administrative assistant, seeing the inner workings of the lobbyists and the lobby organization, and then also the Arts and Business Council. So it was a pretty neat experience, but everyone has to start somewhere. So I'm sure I was getting coffee and making lunches and doing all that, you know, administrative assistant kind of stuff.
Yeah. And then after that, you moved back to Chicago, to be closer to home or?
Yep. I moved back to Chicago and my whole family is here. And it was sort of time. It's hard to be the only one in your family away. And I worked at a charter school on the near south side of Chicago. And then I went to work for the city for 4 years. And this is like this weird kind of sidebar career where when I worked at the city, I thought this is going to be great. It was during the daily administration years. And I got in and I thought, okay, I'm going to go work for the Department of Cultural Affairs, still trying to work like the arts angle. And I actually got hired into the Department of Homeland Security in the Office of Emergency Management and Communications. So
Not art.
It was not touchy-feely. A lot of men in the department who were retired cops or retired firefighter or ex-military. So like the exact opposite of what you might think for someone who wants to sort of be in the social impact space. But I learned a lot about how the city works, how the city doesn't work, who to know, who not to know. and then I realized how much money there was actually this moment where I thought, oh my gosh, there is so much money being poured into Homeland Security and emergency response. And while I think that's super important, kids on the South Side don't have books and teachers are fronting all of these pencils from their own personal budgets. And I thought, there is something fundamentally wrong with the financials and the balance of this. And so I left and I went to go work for a consulting firm.
So when you were at Homeland Security, I think when you and I were talking before the podcast, you said you were hoping that it would somehow you'd be able to apply kind of internally and get a job at the Cultural Center. But in the end, it sounds like you just kept getting promoted.
Yes. that wasn't the goal, but it kept happening. And I became the sort of highest ranking woman in my department at the time. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm becoming like a Homeland Security specialist. This is not actually what I want to do at all. And I would ask to leave departments and to go to all these different kinds of departments. And they would say, no, but you know all this stuff about finance and about grants and all the money coming in. And so I wasn't able to sort of switch departments. And it sort of led to me leaving the city.
Yeah. Were you doing financial operations and grant getting? Like, what was your exact role there? Because in some sense, and I mean, maybe it's because I knew you around this time, like we lived about a block away and had kids the same age, little kids the same age, that, you know, the way I'm understanding your career is it was a sort of a pivotal several years for you that really solidified some of your wants, preferences, values, and things like that. But I also wonder if it was a time when you really leaned into some of the policy, the financial skills, the details of spreadsheets, which we've talked about.
Like, I love a good spreadsheet.
Yeah, I know you do.
I never met a spreadsheet I didn't love, unless it's not color-coded accordingly. During that time, I definitely was managing all of the grant money that was coming out after 9/11. So it was the first time the federal government actually founded a new department, and they poured tons of money into large urban areas and key infrastructure. So the way it worked is based on population, and this whole algorithm formula was how much each city got. And Chicago being one of the largest cities in the country with a high population density, we got a significant amount of money from the federal government. And that money then came in through the Office of Emergency Management, OEMC, and then was divvied up around different city departments. So the police department, fire department, Department of Environment, and a variety of other departments, both like in terms of emergency response and hardening key infrastructure. And so I was responsible for both getting those grants from the Department of Homeland Security and being sort of the liaison. And then once the money was in, managing it internally within those different departments and then reporting back. And so there were a lot of things that sort of, you know, this was very much on people's minds. It was during anthrax. It was during Katrina. And then all the city responses needed to be improved upon in case there was an incident in Chicago. So everything was pretty reactive in terms of the city's needs, but it was pretty interesting to learn about the flow of government funding from the feds to the state, to the city, how that operates, and then this internal coordination within the departments. But yes, I mean, I think to your question, I really had to learn how to be super detail-oriented in terms of financial management, reporting, a variety of different budgets you can imagine keeping track of.
And then did you also have to do like reporting back or support the reporting back to sort of justify the dollars and where all they went and everything?
For sure. Yes, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, the very last thing I did for the city, which was sort of fun, was the Obama rally in Grant Park. And
oh, really?
Yes, because the entire city had to be rerouted. So there was extra security, off-duty police officers, tons of overtime. And if you remember, the city said to the Obama administration, we're not going to pay for this. And the city's citizens were kind of up in arms, like, who's going to pay for this rally in Grant Park? Even though we're super excited, we hope this isn't taxpayer dollars. And so the Obama campaign was paying for it. And so the mayor said to us and our department, like, we need a number how much this rally costs because we have to give the bill to the Obama campaign. And so that was like the very last thing I did was like hand over the bill to the mayor's office to say, like, this is how much you have to bill that campaign. So it was super detailed. Like every single police officer who worked 3.2 hours and the additional security in the streets and sanitation, extra cans and the buses being rerouted. I mean, it was like a huge undertaking in terms of city operations to put that rally together.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's interesting. Like, I'm not a Chicago native, but I do know somebody who worked in the upper administration of police department briefly. And I learned from him about all those underground tunnels.
The tunnels.
Underneath the loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like how when people like Obama as a president or somebody who needs a lot of security needs to get from one place to another, if there's a major emergency, that there are these tunnels under the high rises that kind of hook into Wacker Drive, for those of you that are familiar, and that you have to have a key to like get into the tunnels and stuff. And I was like, what?
I know. On my last day, I asked certain people who had access to those tunnels if I could like take a tour. I did not get a tour. Still like on my bucket list, right? To somehow get a tour of those sites.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, I didn't even know they existed. And unfortunately, I would hook you up, but he's no longer there.
Someday.
All right. Yeah, someday. So you left the city and you joined an already existing consulting firm. Like, did you have a connection already, or how did that happen?
I actually applied through LinkedIn, which is so funny, and nobody gets jobs like that, but I did. And it was a consulting firm that was based in New York and was opening up a Chicago office because they had gotten a grant for $10 million to support 30 after-school programs across the city. And the premise was, if we support the back office infrastructure, can we get better student outcomes? And so many of these after-school programs, you know, they sort of operate paycheck to paycheck or dollar to dollar. And you can imagine how that lack of financial and sort of administrative infrastructure might really hinder student performance or the actual programmatic side. And so they really wanted someone local to kind of lead this initiative and lead the Chicago office. And so I took over that consulting firm and that initiative for 3 years. And right at the end, as that grant was sunsetting, was also 2008 when the market was collapsing. And I really thought to myself, I really like working on the financial side of social impact organizations. It's also, you know, a dancer who wants to start a dance company and is like, but I'm not a numbers person, or an early childhood teacher who is now running a Head Start center and doesn't really have an MBA or a background in finance, but needs to manage an organization. And so I started my own firm when that firm closed, and doing somewhat similar work, but actually kind of different, because I really love how the finance compartment connects to the strategy.
Oh, I see. And so you help, like, it's like the founders or whatever, the leaders might have some amazing idea, but they're not really sure how to get it funded, what to do with the funding, how to allocate the funding, how to grow or scale in a sort of a strategic way. So you did both. Did you do both strategy and funding?
So at Watershed, that's exactly what we do, right? So especially around your last piece around growth. So an organization, potentially we're working with an after-school program that's in, let's say, 10 high schools in Chicago, and they want to scale. They've been having really great success with these students and student outcomes. And they want to think about, like, what would it look like to be in 50 high schools? And does our programmatic model need to change at all because we maybe need to run more efficiently? Or should we actually work in middle schools and connect like the middle school experience to the high school experience? And how do we know which growth path is better? And so we'll come in and we'll use data, maybe looking at what other middle school programs are there, what other after school programs are in the additional 40 high schools you want to go to. And we'll help them, what does your financials look like? And how much money would it take to scale both of these different models? And then we will help them make like a really strategic financial and data-driven decision about growth.
Mm-hmm. When you started this, how did you grow your client base, right? Because, I mean, you must have had some connections from the previous work that you had done, but that's still an awful lot of, like, you're starting your own firm and maybe you get a couple contracts, but then you have to really, do you have to hustle to keep it going?
Sure. I mean, I think any entrepreneur, or especially a solo entrepreneur, is hustling all the time. But I actually think good work begets good work and success begets success. And so I really try to run the mile I'm in and focus on the current clients and doing exceptional work and over-delivering for clients in a way that they feel really great. And it has been 12 years of word of mouth referrals, which has been incredible. And I'm incredibly grateful to do this work that I love and I feel really passionate about and love it at the same time, right? And so it's great.
And never have to worry because of the referral and the good work you're doing. Don't have to worry about other methods, mostly.
Worry a little bit. I'm not going to lie. I'm sending two kids to college and, you know, those checks aren't going to write themselves, but.
No, exactly. Well, right. No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Of course. And I'm intentional about the kinds of clients that I want. I want to work with organizations that are doing work that is aligned with my values in a really deep way. If the NRA came calling, they're a nonprofit, I wouldn't work with the NRA. And some other organizations, you know, there's been a rub on a couple clients that have reached out. But for the most part, I feel grateful that the clients are doing really incredible work in really difficult neighborhoods, everything from like domestic violence to reproductive rights to the arts to climate justice. And across the board, I've gotten to work in a lot of different spaces and I have a lot of different interests. So it sort of keeps it exciting and interesting. And I get to learn about new organizations doing new work.
Yeah. And do you have other people on your team or are you like you do everything?
A little bit of both. I sort of decided early on that I didn't really want to grow a big firm. I had worked for a bigger firm and I saw what the managers and the CEO did and they were managing. And I actually love to do the work and to be in their sort of creative problem solving and crunching numbers. And I didn't want to manage other people. So I do have other people on my team. They're contractors. And I feel deeply grateful for those partnerships, but I'm not managing them. We are working definitely in partnership and I'm learning from them and vice versa. And it's worked out really well for me that way.
What I'm struck by just talking to you at this whole interview and really learning a lot more about the things I didn't know about Amy Kaufman's work is how true you've been able to stay to yourself and what you really want to do throughout your whole career. And I mean, I talk to women all the time who feel like, oh, I've climbed this ladder and I got all these promotions, but now I'm stuck and it's too late to change, or I don't really like what I'm doing. And I mean, do you think that you, I don't know, is it that you're not risk averse? Is it that you really follow your own, like, you know, you can make things work if you really committed to it? Like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I take a big risk every day by working for myself. And that feels super risky. So I don't know that I'm not risk averse, but maybe it's a calculated risk at this point. And remind me of your other question.
I just wondered if it was also something that had to do with like you really trusting yourself and knowing what kind of work fulfills you, makes you feel happy to get out of bed, that kind of, you know, it's like that you're really, really following that.
I mean, there are projects that I would love. Like if you ask me about my dream project or the kinds of organizations that I want to work with, I can tell you, and some of those have been clients and some of those haven't. And I would love the ones that haven't, or even the ones that have, to kind of come back for additional work or to be able to partner with those kinds of, you know, really innovative, creative leaders who are willing to take risks. There's, you know, the world's on fire right now and we need really courageous, bold leaders to tackle those problems. And so those are the kind of leaders that I want to work with, ones that are willing to take the risks and be really audacious in the work that they're doing. However, you need money to do that. And the nonprofit social impact space is notoriously undercapitalized. And I think the way that the whole funding model works, it doesn't actually provide any risk capital. And so I work in a space that is inherently risk adverse. And you always have to report on it. So it's sort of this double standard of we have these incredibly huge problems in our world. I was just reading today about the migrants coming. I mean, there's 1,000 migrants a day coming to Chicago. And I'm not sure what the administration is supposed to do with the influx, the sheer number of people coming into our city. And at the same time, my heart is with these people who have fled horrible situations and want a better life. And just the resources, both money, beds, everything. Yeah. Chicago does not have the resources to provide for these individuals. And so we're inherently like that is creating a really contentious situation. And so I think the money and the resources and the capital structure to solve these big equations need new models and new systems. So those are the kind of projects I would love. And those are risk adverse. They might fail.
Right, right. They're inherently risky because they're new and sort of untested. And also, they're big, you know? Like, it's the migrant problem in Chicago, and I agree with you on the politics of it. It's so big that it's kind of hard to even get your brain wrapped around the kind of resources that that would require. And if there isn't a new model, then there's no resource. You know what I mean? I get what you're saying, that what you're really interested in are those kinds of projects that might be able to do that at scale in a really unique or innovative way.
And it's hard finding those projects, being at the epicenter of them. And I could tell you 10 other smaller sectors within the nonprofit space that are facing these huge mega crises, right? To say nothing of climate change, to say nothing of the conundrum of reproductive rights and the fall of Roe and what that's done to healthcare for women and people who want to have abortions. And right, like I could across the board. And so there's just not enough of these deep thinkers and people with enough resources to allow for the creativity that other sectors have. And so those are the kind of projects I'm attracted to. I want to work on. And I don't know, I'm putting that out there for 2024.
We're going to manifest it with the podcast. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, which I think flows nicely from what we were just discussing, is on your LinkedIn title, it says, which PS I will link in the show notes. Amy will send that information to me. You have financial activist, I think, as a title. Could you talk a little bit about like where that came from? Like, is that something you started with? Did it develop over time? Like, how do people talk to you about that? What resonance does it have? Because it certainly resonated with me. So I'm just curious about what it means to you and your clients.
I love talking about it. And I think money can be a huge lever for change. And I'm increasingly interested in how we unlock financial capital for social change and how big movements do that. And I think that putting your money in alignment with your values is probably one of the most powerful things you can do. And it's everything from, I don't want to shop at Hobby Lobby because they don't support my values, to looking at where my retirement funds are, to looking at where my kid is going to college, in what state, and how those dollars speak to that, to right, to where I'm supporting in terms of my philanthropic capital, to where I might be banking and what credit cards I'm using. So across the board, I think individuals, nonprofits, can think of themselves as the asset holders, and being able to really put our financial resources very much in alignment with the things that we care about and the way that we want to see the world. And, you know, men have controlled the money and the world for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And we're in some really hot water right now in a lot of different places. And I think if other people controlled the money, our world would look a lot differently.
100%. The intro of my podcast is something about women being in leadership, and more women in leadership would change the world. More women in leadership sort of is equivalent to power and money, and being able to leverage that in a way that's aligned with our values, and values that sort of more center the care for our fellow humans, right? And what we can do to sort of tackle some of the biggest issues of our time. I'm still back on financial activists. Tell me, like, what kind of conversations do you get in with people about them? I mean, not just me, like, curious, like, tell me about it, but like, do potential clients remark on it? Do you have people DMing you on LinkedIn? Like, what does it bring up? Like, I want to know.
What if people DMing me on LinkedIn about it? I would love to. But I talk about it with all of my clients. It's really at the heart of what I do, because I think the way organizations think about themselves, I'm doing a lot of work in reproductive rights right now, and mm-hmm. they've always thought of themselves as these small sort of grassroots activist nonprofits, right? Most of abortion funds were volunteer-led. And with the fall of Roe, actually, there's been a lot of donor engagement, which has led to more revenue. And so I'm working with a lot of abortion funds to actually think of themselves as asset holders. And what does that mean? And they actually have power because they're starting to have money for the first time ever. And what does that mean? We need more sophisticated systems. We have a choice who we bank with. And what does that mean? And do we want to be banking with Chase Bank, who is invested in private prisons, which is really against the reproductive justice movement? Or do we want to be banking with a credit union or a more community-minded bank that is potentially supporting women and other people who need abortions and healthcare? Right, let's dig deeper and say, what are the policies of those banks that you are choosing to put your money with? And mm-hmm. do they offer comprehensive contraception? Are they selling data about people who buy mifepristone? So there are a lot of ways that I think people can leverage finance really as this tool for activism. And I think other movements, ones that I might be not in alignment with, have done it very well. And I think the things that I care about, we could really learn and start to do that. And, you know, there's people working on shareholder activism. So if you own shares mm-hmm. of a company and a proxy resolution comes up, are you exercising your right as a shareholder to really dig in and understand what that issue is? And obviously, the more money you own and more shares you own at a company, the more voice you have. And how do we exercise that? And collectively, how can movements really dig in? And, you know, there's been a real big movement to divest from fossil fuels in terms of mutual funds. Yep. And I think that's just the beginning. And there are many, many other social movements that could benefit from that kind of financial activism.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, here's the thing. It makes so much sense. It makes all of the sense in the world. And it's not something you hear talked about very much, right? There's, I mean, a little bit of like in the like sort of social responsibility of corporations kind of space or things like that. But when you talk about it from the other point of view, like from an organizational or nonprofit point of view, it's like you're providing some information and resources for them to think about things that they might not have otherwise thought now that they do have more capital from donations or whatever, right?
I'm also trying to democratize it, right? So
yeah.
You don't have to be the MacArthur Foundation with the largest endowment. You can be Amy Kaufman, and what am I doing with my own capital that I have? Where am I banking? And how am I talking about this? And how am I thinking myself as an important asset holder? And so I made the decision probably 5 years ago to really dig into every single part of my own financial portfolio, as whatever size that might be. And what ended up happening was I wanted to divest from a lot of things that were not in alignment with my values. I ended up firing my financial planner, hiring a new one that actually only worked in impact and impact investing, and feel really good about the kinds of investments and where my money is, that really I'm trying to leave a better world for not just my kids, but seven generations forward.
Yeah. 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 It's amazing. Like, we can all personally model that. And in your case, you're also helping organizations of any size, nonprofits of any size, also think about their own finances in the same way.
And it's hard, right? Like, who wants to come home at the end of the workday and think about, like, where am I banking? And then really think about, like, well, there's Chases everywhere and their app is so easy to use and it's hard to switch banks, or it's hard to actually take the time to dig into, you know, I just have a mutual fund, but a mutual fund is actually, you know, 100 companies, little teeny shares of each of those companies, or funds of funds. And it's really actually pretty difficult to figure out all the nasty stuff that you're invested in. And then it doesn't feel good. And then you have to figure out a new advisor, which funds I should be in, and all these sort of questions. And it often falls to the bottom of the list. But I feel really deeply that actually, you know, the amount of money that I give to charity or give philanthropically is a pretty small percentage of what's actually making a much bigger impact on the world, is the money that I have invested, and thinking about the harm that that is doing. And is that more than canceling out what I'm giving to nonprofits?
Yeah. Do you have any recommendations for places to start for somebody who really wants to dig into this as an individual?
I love this website called Mighty Deposits, and you can go on there and it lists, you can type in almost any bank and they can tell you how community-minded that bank is. So that's a great place to start just on banking. I think there is a website called As You Sow, and you can go in and look at different mutual funds, I think, in different stocks, and it can tell you things that you're invested in. Elevest is a pretty big platform now that is particularly geared towards women. And there's so many kinds of different investment opportunities or screening platforms, depending if you're interested in gender lens investing. So that's really thinking about putting women and potentially the LGBTQ plus community at the heart of what you do. There are different kinds of screens for that. If you're interested in climate change, right? There's that's probably the most prolific in terms of screens and divesting and investing kinds of, there's specific screens if you're Jewish and want to support different movements. And I'm sure in other religions, there are other screens as well. So some of those I know, and I'm happy to talk to people about this endlessly.
Oh, good. Well, maybe we'll get some DMs. Amy, thank you so much. I've learned a ton, not just about what you do, but I am super impressed by how aligned your values are and your activism is with your work and all of the good work you're doing in the city of Chicago and beyond for the greater good of the community and the country and our world. So I really am super grateful you were able to be here. If you want to know more about Amy, I will have all of her information in the show notes. Amy, any other thing that you want to add before we sign off?
I'm so grateful to be able to talk to you. And it's really fun when my personal and my professional worlds commingle, because they often do. And that's sort of my favorite nexus. So
yeah. Thanks.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode and interview with Amy Kaufman. What an incredible interview that was. So many things to think about. I just want to thank her for sharing the story of her career path, but also her wisdom about finances and nonprofits and really, really thinking about the dollars that you invest and how you're investing them. The things that I took away from this episode have to do with this idea of financial activism, right? How and where we choose to invest and allocate our resources, and how that can have a huge impact. And that doesn't just mean, as Amy described, that, you know, you're going to be very careful about who you donate dollars to, but it also means where you're investing your money for retirement, where you have your savings account. And I love how she is so clear about the impact that individuals can make in this way, that it's not just about huge organizations and how they invest their dollars, but it's about how we as individuals can be really mindful and careful about where and how our savings are invested. I also thought this career path of hers, from being an art major to founding this Studio Watershed and doing financial advising and assisting nonprofits, was really fascinating. And the thread that keeps going through it for me, as it does in many of these podcasts, is just how important it was to Amy to do meaningful work, right? That she got a lot of experience at the city of Chicago. She learned a lot of things when she was in her role in Homeland Security. But at the end of her time there, she realized that she just was frustrated by the juxtaposition of all these dollars coming in for security and no dollars coming in for the public schools, right? Not that security is not important, but just how we are underfunding really critical and important social goods and services in our society right now. And so I really think that her shift into working with nonprofits and supporting them to scale and meet their financial obligations is something that she takes like a great deal of pride and meaning in for herself, and that she really truly has a purpose and feels aligned with the kind of work that she's doing. Not that she always has, not that it was easy to get there, right? But that she did end up finding herself there. I hope that you take away these lessons from this episode about meaningful work and about financial activism, and that they give you food for thought about your own financial investments and savings, as well as your own career. Thanks for being here. I'm glad that you were able to listen. If doing meaningful, aligned work is really important to you, I would love to talk you through that and hear your story and support you on a Voice Your Value call. You can sign up and get on my calendar at voiceyourvaluecall.com, and we can discuss how you can pivot your career, go for that promotion, or change a little bit of something at work so that you feel you are doing purposeful and aligned work. And I will see you next week. And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.
This has been an Awkward Sage production.